Chapter 10, Triads and Stage 4 Networking. Every September, a remarkable party takes place at which people in commercial real estate discuss and close more business than perhaps on any other night of the year. At the center of the party is C.B. Richard Ellis Vice Chair, Darla Longo. In 2006, the party took up the entire 15th floor of the Clift Hotel in San Francisco. Longo wore a turquoise dress and diamonds, sipping the same drink for hours. Many of the 300-plus attendees showed less restraint, keeping the bartenders busy. The event had the feel of a fraternity party, but with the attendees 35 years older and wearing gray pants and blue blazers. Longo's behavior was the most remarkable part of the event, and most missed her magic. She didn't promote herself, talk about her accomplishments, or say I, me, or my, other than to say, I'd like you to meet so-and-so. Longo played matchmaker. She introduced clients to brokers, senior brokers to successful rookies, and clients to one another. If we were to take any moment of the evening and watch it in slow motion, we'd see three elements. First, Longo would have at least two people around her. Second, she would talk to them both at the same time, even if they didn't know each other. Third, if we listened to her words, we'd notice that they have the effect of building or deepening the relationship between the other two people. If we look closer at this third element, we'd see that Longo is introducing people at two levels. First, she's going through resume issues, who each person works for and what he's doing. Why it is such a good idea for these two people to meet each other. Second, and far more important, she's discussing what makes each great as a person, his or her core values. As Longo snakes her way around the floor of the hotel, and as people shuffle around to meet her, the most remarkable aspect of this night becomes apparent. Once she leaves, people talk about her. Her vision in setting up this event almost 10 years ago, how it has grown to become one of the defining moments of the year in commercial real estate, how Longo runs her business within C.B. Richard Ellis, and what an accomplished leader she is. All the things that people at Stage 3 might say about themselves, others say about Darla after she's left. Longo emerged as one of the leaders in commercial real estate for many reasons: her drive, endless energy, talent, vision for the business, and focus on integrity and values. In our years of watching her, one simple behavior stands out: her ability to triad, to create business relationships between two people based on core values and mutual self-interest, and then move on. She naturally receives the reciprocal benefit of this action by others saying good things about her, and her resulting reputation is a magnet for business. In essence, she receives loyalty and followership by creating relationships between other people. She is one of the most successful people in commercial real estate because her actions build triads, the basic building block of a Stage 4 tribe. The structure of Stage 4 relationships. We didn't invent the triad. We just recognized it. We saw many tribal leaders forming large networks of people. Longo's list of contacts would not fit in some PDAs, and yet she does not seem to suffer from a lack of time. People at Stage 3 assume that successful groups will fail as they get larger, while those at Stage 4 keep adding members. Once the tribe gets bigger than 150 people, it splits into two tribes, each filled with triads. Some people can then form triads between the new tribes, effectively creating one culture, one firm. Glenn Esnard's early work with the private client group caused some people to say that the group would collapse under its own weight when it hit 50 professionals. It's over 250 and growing. IDEO wasn't supposed to keep its special culture when it got larger than 100 people. It's at 450. And Amgen was going to become just another big drug company culture when it hit 1,000 employees. It's now over 16,000. The triad is so powerful that it can link tribes of 150 people together, creating an unlimited capacity for scalability. The purpose of this chapter is to reverse engineer what we saw thousands of tribal leaders doing, establishing three-legged relationships all around them. The triad is the basic building block of stage four cultures, and these blocks can be stacked to the sky, resulting in large, robust, dynamic, and growing networks of tribes. All are vibrant, values-based, and filled with people giving their best efforts, leading and being led at the same time. As we saw in Chapter 6, dyads, two-person relationships, are the structural hallmark of Stage 3. People operating at I'm great tend to form a set of dyads, so that if they have to tell lots of people the same thing, they'll have a series of one-on-one conversations. As a result, they hit several barriers. First, the person at the other end of the relationship often feels commoditized, valued only for her service or information. Second, the person forming the dyads feels he never has enough time or support, since the overhead maintenance required to keep a series of dyads together is enormous. Third, people are quick to spot inconsistencies in what the person says, as he tells slightly different versions of the same thing to others, which damages his credibility and reduces their loyalty to him. In this chapter, we'll present the anatomy of a triad in detail, discuss its three main advantages, stability, innovation, and scalability, and show how it can become a launching pad to stage five. The anatomy of a triad. At its most basic level, a triad has three parts. In its most stable form, the three parts are people, such as Longo, a client, and another professional from CB Richard Ellis. The three form a triangle, with each leg of the structure responsible for the quality of the relationship between the other two parts. The stabilizing power of triads. Bruce Cutter, CEO of Cancer Care Northwest, runs a remarkable organization. On the surface, Dr. Cutter is successful because he hires great people, has a sound business model, and is a dedicated physician executive. This surface view misses the remarkable part of his leadership. Cutter uses triads to resolve conflicts, to develop his staff, and to give everyone more time. As we toured his facility, a single moment showed how triads immunize tribes against the disagreements that creep into every workplace. A staff member came up to him, glanced at us, and then looked back at him, rolling his eyes. "He's doing it again," the staff member complained. We later learned that he was referring to another physician who wasn't following an administrative procedure, and as a result, the staff had to do extra work. Cutter's steady voice said, "You and the doctor should work it out. You both want the same thing, but you see different paths for how to get there. You'll find a path that works for you both, and tell him I said that." And with those few words, Cutter resumed our tour. We later learned that the two had met and resolved their dispute. In the process, both were reminded to work together, the most important element in employee development. They resolved the disagreement in real time, without having to wait for Cutter's involvement. And his time was free to do what was most important, gaining respect for the tribe by showing it off to visitors, including new patients. When you use triads to solve problems, remind people of shared values. Values, as we saw in Chapter 9, lead to alignment, which trumps any disagreement. Just as Dr. Cutter did in this example, tribal leaders remind people engaged in a spat that they're really on the same page with what matters, values. If people don't see the common ground, tribal leaders point it out. As we heard Glenn Esnard say in an early private client group meeting to two people who disagreed on an issue, "You both signed an agreement that says the team comes first. What's best for the team here?" With that, he walked away, and the two people resolved their disagreement. If Cutter had been operating at stage three, he would have said, as we have heard thousands of times from thousands of managers, "I'll look into it. Thanks for letting me know." He would then have talked with the physician, gotten his side of it, and perhaps said that the administrator didn't get it since he's not a doctor. He then would have gone back to the staff member, heard his side of it, and perhaps said that the doctor, while a brilliant clinician, didn't get administrative issues. He then would have had to have gone back to both with his decision and used tools of persuasion to get them to comply. In essence, he would have dealt with the problem by creating dyads, requiring his time and attention. Next time a disagreement happened, he would have repeated the process, and thus his days would be consumed by conflict management. He, like many people in our study, would work late, going home to a midnight dinner, and complaining to his wife that he doesn't get enough support and that he's the only one holding the office together. Instead, a few sentences resolved the problem and restored the relationship. Instead of staying late to work on the problem, Cutter went out to dinner with us, and we talked about his group and their aspirations for the future. Like many tribal leaders, Cutter didn't see the pattern until we interviewed him about it. "Wow, that's remarkable," he said on the phone later, when we stepped him through what we had seen. "I never knew I did that." Once he had the concept, he described how most of his day is spent building triads. He also saw that triads could involve bringing groups together. In an excited voice, he described a new initiative to identify the components of quality in his oncology practice. He realized that the initiative could work only if he was involved, but that it had to be owned by other stakeholders. He is active in building the relationship between two groups, healthcare professionals and staff, effectively creating a larger triad. As is always true in triads, each group builds the relationship between the other group and Cutter, meaning that he is always informed and the relationship moves forward even when he is busy with other projects. Once tribal leaders see the concept of the triad, they see it everywhere. Cutter pointed out that his career has been built on triads. Glenn Esnard began looking at the private client group as a collection of triads, and he used his Saturday afternoons watching football as opportunities to invite new people into his triads. After one person saw the idea, he noted his family life is stable because he builds the relationship between his wife and his mother-in-law. Every time he and his wife fight, friends or parents-in-law remind them of how important the relationship is to both of them. Spats happen, but the relationship remains stable and vibrant. Triads are undermined when senior decision-makers solve problems themselves. What's even worse is when they say, "Don't go behind my back," as this crushes triads as they form. Some people resist building triads because they think they'll lose control. Their thought is that this technique may encourage people to undercut them. However, the opposite is true. The rule of reciprocity implies whatever you give out, you'll get back. If you build the relationship between two people and then walk away, most of them will praise your efforts. You've increased the respect you get by showing the same to other people. David Kelly describes the point this way. He said, "I never mediate a conflict. If it's working for a client, let the client sort it out. What do I know?" Not only do forming and nurturing triads save the tribal leader time, they encourage a level of followership that is unimaginable at stage three. A test of a true tribal leader is why people would come to their funeral. Do the words of praise stem from their hearts or from a desire to be politically correct? While we hope Darla Longo's eulogy is a long way off, one thing is certain. It will be standing room only, and the tears will be real. People don't just value her because of business she sent their way, but because she gets them. She knows them by their values, and she is known by hers, with integrity and service at the top of the list. The same is true for Bruce Cutter, Glenn Esnard, Stephen Sample, and David Kelly. When Gordon Binder's time comes, many people who never knew him will mourn his loss. Thankfully, this level of loyalty, respect, and followership pays dividends while people are still alive. Most of the tribal leaders we studied are on the short list of candidates considered for CEO positions, or positions of even more prestige. The triad provides a level of support that comes as a surprise to people who are used to dealing at stage three. Frank Jordan, referring to his work at the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, said about people who receive funding money, "It's not like we give you the money and walk away. We ask, how can we help to get you to the finish line? We're totally invested in these projects, and not just with our finances." Most Moore Foundation projects involve a triad between the foundation, the recipient, and the group served by the recipient. In essence, the foundation is responsible for the quality of the relationship between the latter two groups. Funding is merely the mechanism to get started, not the final result. In a triad, no one is ever slogging through a problem alone. Triads as magnets for innovation. In 1978, Angelica Terriot was admitted to a large San Francisco hospital with a disease no one could identify. After almost dying several times, she was finally diagnosed with a rare but treatable virus. A native of Argentina, she marveled at the technological sophistication of American medicine, but was appalled at the dehumanizing method of treatment. She complained about the nurses coming and going, paying her no more attention than they paid to the equipment. She spent hours alone, fearing for her life, often staring at a blank wall. Although the quality of medical treatment was superior in the United States, she said that in Argentina, she would have been treated like a human being. When she was discharged, she resolved to change the system. She approached the CEO of the hospital with her complaints and was given a polite brush off. Although she was married to the publisher of the San Francisco Examiner, she never used the power of her husband's influence to embarrass the hospital or the system. Later, Terriot's father-in-law had a stroke and was hospitalized. In the words of a friend, the insults kept coming. He was a powerful man, and he was being spoken to like a baby. Terriot then pulled together a group of visionary friends, the seed of a new tribe, and went to work. They imagined a medical system where patients could become partners and active participants in their treatment, not merely examples of biology. They started by clipping periodicals about disease, from gallbladder illness to cancer. Terriot opened a small medical library in a hospital that was staffed with volunteers, and it soon had a steady stream of traffic. Patients learned about their diseases and so could take a more active role in medical decisions. This initial success impressed the same CEO who had rebuffed Terriot, and he now asked how she could take the model further. Terriot and a group of medical advisors formed Plane Tree, named after the type of sycamore tree in ancient Greece under which Hippocrates taught the first medical students. In 1985, the organization helped run a 13-bed medical surgical department in the hospital. Plane Tree broke one piece of conventional wisdom after another by putting art on the walls, turning medical records over to patients, and opening kitchens. At the heart of the model is partnership revolving around the patients. This experiment, monitored by the University of Washington, was hugely successful. Susan Frampton, the current president of Plane Tree, said, "Then they took this experience to four other hospitals. Could you do it in New York City? Could you do it in a community-based hospital? In long-term care?" Again and again, the Plane Tree model worked as it triaded all the pieces of the healthcare model together: doctors, nurses, support staff, administrators, architects, and most especially, patients. Plane Tree brings together everyone involved with care so that the patient feels informed and involved in the medical developments and is treated like a whole human being. Plaintree now has 112 affiliate hospitals in North America and Europe. One of those hospitals is Griffin, a story we've revisited several times in this audiobook. As impressive as the Plaintree story is, it's how Griffin used the organization and contributed back to it that shows how Stage 4 tribes will almost always outperform Stage 3. CEO administrators, in the words of Griffin Vice President Bill Pawanda, seemed to go nuts, in a good way, for anything that would help during their turnaround. CEO Charmel said, "When we started, people thought we were a little wacky. They brought in Plaintree consultants, hired out-of-the-box architects, and brought in Innovation Associates, a consulting group started by MIT's Peter Senge. Pawanda told us, if it worked, we tried it. They focused on process redesign, training, committing to values, and focusing on the patient. At each step, the administration helped form a triad, bringing together consultants, including those from Plaintree, with hospital leaders. They ensured the quality of the relationship on all sides, and then watched to see whether or not it worked. Most of what they brought in made an impact, so they retained it. When an approach hit the point of diminishing returns, they moved on. In each case, the organizations and people they brought in were left more capable for having worked with Griffin. Ultimately, Griffin saw its ideal partner in the San Francisco-based Plaintree, which was having its own problems at the time. Current Plaintree President Frampton explains, "Membership grew to a point where the lack of experience and knowledge of the hospital culture became an Achilles heel to the organization. Griffin had just joined as an affiliate and didn't want its guide to flounder. Hospital executives eventually acquired the debts of Plaintree, essentially acquiring the organization and moving its headquarters to the East Coast. Over time, the board changed and now had more seats for affiliates. The transformation worked both ways, with Griffin now the model Plaintree Hospital and Plaintree gaining credibility from the buzz about Griffin. When people want to learn about one, they also learn about the other. Both are now integrating other hospitals into Plaintree's affiliate program, resulting in better health care for everyone." Many Stage 3 organizations reject innovations they didn't originate, a situation often called the "not invented here" syndrome. Stage 4 organizations, like Griffin, will actively pull in resources, approaches, consultants, ideas, or anything else that will build the tribe. Plaintree has been so successful in getting resources and keeping its members that it works on word-of-mouth buzz alone. In the language of tribal leadership, the organization relies on people triading them in, and so far, it's worked very well. Frampton told us, "We don't advertise. We have chosen to not spread the word, but to let people find us." She adds, referring to the benefits of core values-based relationships, "We have low attrition, and it comes from buy-in from the heart as well as from the head." Again and again, we saw Stage 4 organizations triading in innovation. IDEO brings in experts on almost any subject, provided they're really world-class, to see what learning emerges from the interaction. Men's Wearhouse George Zimmer added spiritual author Deepak Chopra to the board of directors of his publicly traded company. When we asked Zimmer how the other members of the board responded, he said, "One of our board members asked me, 'Who is Chopra?' I laughed and told him to go ask his wife. His wife told him, and now he's all for it. Chopra's great." Zimmer triaded an innovative person and a new perspective with the investment bankers on his board. Triads and business development. Reid Hoffman, co-founder of LinkedIn, is one of the emerging experts on personal networking in the internet age. The company allows users to request to join someone's personal network of contacts and thus gain access to their tribe. The system always asks permission of a connector before getting two people in touch. Like most people at work changing the world, Hoffman connects his role in this new age to his values. He told us, "I am interested in what happens when you use the internet as a force for massive change, creating viable economic benefits and improving people's lives." Hoffman bases LinkedIn on the belief that lifetime employment is going the way of the dodo, and that in the new economy, in his words, every professional in the world will have an electronic shingle that will be on the net. He adds, from a business perspective, 80 to 90% of the reason that a person would spend time with other people is based on referrals. He imagined a system that would allow a user to request an introduction to another user, a mini form of the triad. We learned this lesson the hard way. In setting up interviews for this book, Hoffman was on our short list. We emailed, faxed, and called the LinkedIn PR office. A member of Hoffman's team saw our note and emailed me, suggesting that a good way to connect the founder might be through the system he founded. Duh. I logged on to LinkedIn, requested a connection to Reid Hoffman, and learned he was one person away, through my best friend in high school. I requested that he introduce us, essentially building a triad, and 2 weeks later, we were talking. In his introduction, my friend referred to shared values, as well as to personal accomplishments and what each would gain from the meeting. Hoffman told us, "What most people don't understand is that if you manage your career, what you are doing is actually managing a set of relationships. People need an infrastructure for that within their heads." He argued that the mental model of business card networking isn't good enough for the new economy. He proposed, "What happens is that educational institutions have a serious break with the reality of modern careers. The means about how to progress to a modern career is lacking. Things to do around building and managing and maintaining your career are simply not taught the right way anywhere." From our experience, he's right. A major part of business school career management is industry nights, in which industry leaders, mostly alumni from the school, come and talk about what they do and then network with MBA students. Most job seekers consider a great industry night one from which they walk away having made a good impression on people and getting a stack of business cards. They then email the industry leaders, often saying, "It was great meeting you. I would love to help your company. Can we continue talking?" An industry leader is deluged with such correspondence, and even the best intended of them ends up not responding to many notes, which frustrates the students. It's a classic stage 3 model to get jobs. As Hoffman notes, dyads are ineffective in job hunting. We would add that two-person relationships are also incapable of running an organization, building new business, or achieving great results. Hoffman continued, "The way business schools teach career management has to change. It lacks the context for success. In fact, when tribal leaders discuss triading in business schools, they get looks of shock. Why hasn't anyone taught this before?" many students ask. The triad is one of those ideas that is obvious when you see it, but until you do, it's invisible. All Darla Longo has to do is introduce a new person into her community, such as introducing a prospective client to another broker within her company, and the group will describe the benefits of working with her. At stage 4, the tribe closes new business or gets jobs for people. In describing this facet of triads to MBA students, someone will often say, "That sounds like network marketing," or "Isn't that how Amway works?" People usually laugh. Actually, it's exactly how multi-level marketing organizations work, and growing religions, and expanding businesses, and booming law practices, and populist political campaigns. It's why so many people saw the Blair Witch Project, and how successful business schools expand their applicant pool. Dylan Stafford, the director of admissions for the fully employed MBA programs at UCLA, turns information sessions into triading events in which prospective candidates meet current students and successful alumni. Stafford does what tribal leaders do, sets the tone, trains the volunteers, leads the people doing the work, and then lets the tribe grow on its own. His applicant pool is expanding geometrically, as is the enthusiasm of prospects for a UCLA MBA. Scaling tribal effectiveness within triads. IDEO forms triads so quickly that what clients see is a blizzard of networked activity, bringing together experts from many different fields, everyone contributing ideas and leveraging off one another's wisdom. Experts from the firm went to work with a healthcare provider and noticed that physicians and medical assistants sat too far apart. So IDEO worked to bring them together, literally and figuratively. The consultants also saw that the clinical spaces kept family members away from patients, making them feel isolated and disconnected, aspects of stage two. IDEO human factors experts noticed that patients often sat in exam rooms for quite a while, feeling vulnerable and alone. The IDEO design team asked executives to walk through the system as patients, and they came to the same conclusions as the consultants, that all those systems had to change. In essence, the IDEO experts didn't act as experts at all, which is a stage three model, but as matchmakers, introducing physicians to assistants, staff to family members, patients to staff, and executives to clinical employees. The result of all this webbing of relationships was that the patient experience changed from one of isolation to one of support. IDEO's original mission was to help design new facilities, but instead they triaded groups to other groups. As a result, they fixed the problem without adding new facilities. Patient satisfaction scores increased. At the center of this effort, IDEO and the client redefined nurses' roles to include what Kelly calls creative responsibilities, adding, "And now they're happy as clams." By rapidly building triads, experts become partners, clients become teachers, and everything can change. Upgrading a tribe, one triad at a time. David Kelly has two professional passions, IDEO and Stanford. He told us, "Tending IDEO's culture is like falling off a log compared to what's going on at the university." The traditional role of professor has been described as sage on a stage. It's like a group dental practice, with experts living in separate offices. Getting people of all kinds to change their lifelong habits of operating independently and start to operate as a team is a big challenge. Kelly says, "At Stanford Design School, we're looking at the entire academic model. Stanford is winning the hell out of Nobel Prizes, and that's a great thing that comes from deep expertise. What we're trying to do is give the students another tool, a tool we call design thinking. If you're using design thinking, you're inviting students to collaborate in the learning process. By having multiple professors in the classroom with different points of view, the students will need to make up their own minds about what matters to them, not what matters to the professors. I think this is ultimately going to change the fundamental way we approach learning in order to equip people with a broader set of tools for solving the big problems in the world." As Kelly draws on his whiteboard at IDEO, he adds, "In universities, we keep building these disciplines of knowledge. Within each department, we're doing really well. But the innovation we're missing lies in between those disciplines. We need a new approach to facilitate collaboration between the departments. That's where design thinking comes in. We have world-class individuals, but the new world-class requires that these world-class guys talk to each other." Kelly is using a triad of professors to turbocharge learning. With the blessing of Stanford President John Hennessy, he is running a class with two other professors, a business professor and a social scientist. In his signature Midwestern charm, Kelly describes what actually happens. "We're in the classroom. The business guy, a fantastic teacher, says he's working on a project in India to get rid of kerosene and use solar. He says, If you don't write it down, it doesn't exist. I can't let him say that. So I bring up the importance of intuition and insight, which causes a heated debate to break out. After a while, the social scientist says, "What do you mean by exists? The learning is incredible. There's no right answer. These guys are really passionate." And then we have a more esoteric discussion. The students are watching the whole thing. Their nervousness is about who's going to do the grading. At the end of every class, we debrief, with students all around us. This never happens when there is only one professor in the classroom, but here these three guys debrief. Every once in a while, one of us will say, "What do you think?" to one of the students. They have to decide for themselves what is the right thing to do. Not only do students in the course observe triads, but they're organized into groups of about five for class projects. A group of five is 10 potential triads if everyone is webbed to everyone else. Kelly says it's a blast. You get a business student, an engineer, a social scientist, and each one gets to play the role of expert along with a couple of others. We put them through training so they can spot dysfunctional team behavior and deal with it. Kelly's experiment is a large network of triads. Kelly says, the learning is incredible. It's also his attempt to change the culture of Stanford and become a model for other universities to follow. He said, these are really smart people, pointing back to his diagram of focused disciplines. They're constantly benchmarking success. Stanford wants people to be trained in the deep thinking of their individual disciplines, as well as collaborating with other disciplines to drive innovation. As we have more and more success with this, others will want to join in. It's about changing the entire system. We would add, change happens one triad at a time. Preparing for world-class triading. We're often asked how people can get the most out of triads. From our research, we'll offer four pointers. First, know the values and current projects of every person in your network. Darla Longo's introductions model the best practice. Introduce people on both levels, and this is possible only by knowing each person. There's no shortcut for knowing who is in your tribe and what's important to them and what they're doing. As Longo told us a few days before her party, we all want the same thing. The rookies and clients are all looking for personal growth and how to be better at what we do. She speaks with confidence because she knows the interests and values of almost every person at her party. Second, use what LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman describes as the theory of small gifts. Before facilitating an introduction between two people, you have to have the credibility with both to pull it off. Hoffman describes the need for this practice to be systematic and ongoing. He says, do little things for each person, such as sending them an article that is about one of their interests, remembering their birthday, and so on. Third, be great at something, world class if possible. We're often asked by people at stage two how they can triad with people who won't even return their calls. The answer is they first have to go through stage three and become great at something, just as Kelly and his two Stanford colleagues all entered and then graduated from stage three. If someone hasn't owned stage three yet, world-class triading will be difficult, bordering on impossible. Finally, there was a point in our research at which we believed that if people at stage three were to triad, they would automatically grow into stage four. We were wrong. Unless someone has had the epiphany of tribal leadership, triading looks like thinly veiled self-promotion. Effective triading requires a word that we heard people use again and again to describe real leaders: authenticity. Launchpad to stage five. Triading is a key not only to stabilizing at stage four, but to beginning the leap to stage five. Life is great, and the subject of part four of this book. Frank Jordan explains how it works at the Moore Foundation. He says, it's a third career for me, after chief of police and mayor, and it's so amazing to see. The Nobel Prize winners that come through this door in environment, science, technology, oceanography, education, health, to listen to them, and then to hear some of our people talk with them. The passion, commitment, vision, and have you thought about it this way or that way approach. Next thing you know, we've completely redone our plans so we can get even better results. Doing something no one has ever done, really making history. Triading brings together a group of people that can accomplish the nearly impossible, the history-making performance of Stage 5. Key points from this chapter. 1. Know the values, current projects, and aspirations of each person in your tribe. 2. Use Reid Hoffman's theory of small gifts to build your relationship with people in your tribe as preparation for triading. 3. Form a triad by introducing two people to each other on the basis of current projects and shared values. There's no substitute for going through Stage 3 so that you're known for some area of expertise. Doing so will give you the credibility to triad with others.